Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
This may well be the week we all remember as the week that capitalism came up against climate change. 300,000 people on the streets of the world's financial capital. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Monday, the 22nd of September. Good as always to have you here, everybody. There is a big United Nations climate summit this week. All the heavies will be there, President Obama included, in New York City. As prelude, if you will, as many as 300,000 people took to the streets of Manhattan this past weekend, trying to focus attention on what have largely been honored in the breach commitments to do something about a warming planet. And in a nifty coincidence of timing, the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, yes, those Rockefeller Brothers, has announced plans to divest itself of its investment in fossil fuels. Irony is what you call that. Marketplace's Scott Tong is in New York for us this week. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Kai, how are you?
I'm good. So big week, big weekend in New York City. Those 300,000 people yesterday, and then the news today of the Rockefeller Brothers Fund saying it's going to divest from fossil fuels company. Can we say that this is now climate change has met the market, if you will?
Well, there's a lot of talk about capitalism and climate change. With regard to the Rockefeller announcement, what's clear is this is a symbolic announcement. There's a lot of talk of divesting in oil and gas companies with Foundation and others, but let's be clear, the amount of selling off would pale in comparison to the size of most of these big companies. So it's a symbol. Symbols matter, the same way 300,000 people marching in New York is trying to matter. It certainly mattered with regard to divestment in South Africa. But you also have reality. You have powerful voices in the business community saying, you know what, we're doing real things here. Tim Cook of Apple was speaking here today, and he said, you know, we all need to ask if we really want to leave a legacy of leaving the world worse off.
Well, so tell me more about reality. I mean, there are things going on in New York and elsewhere as well, right?
Oh, absolutely. And it just feels different from other climate conversations. I was at the Global Climate Summit in Mexico 4 years ago, and you and I talked, and I overheard a participant there saying, you know, where are the bankers? Well, the bankers are here this week. They are everywhere talking about the opportunities of a low-carbon economy. Solar and wind energy, they say, are worth investing in because in many places they can compete against coal and gas, you know, with or without subsidies. There are tens of billions of dollars going toward bonds that invest in low-carbon technologies, not because of polar bears, but because the return on investment is good. I mean, this is the reality they're trying to send national capitals. And Kai, today I interviewed the CEO and president of IKEA, Peter Agnefjäll, and he said business increasingly is part of the solution.
You know the phrase, winners go to market, losers go to Washington, around negative lobbying? That has been too dominant for too long. And the initiative We Mean Business that's been launched today is to exactly counteract that, to say the business community is ready to have a positive dialogue with policymakers.
And Kai, that's really the feeling here is, you know, this is New York. We really do things here. There's talk of accountants changing the world. There's talk of the policymaker climate nabobs just talking and talking. So, you know, this is reality trying to confront the policymaker saying this is what we can do.
Yeah, but how much is going to happen without some kind of concerted government action? I mean, you know, you drive 4 hours south on I-95 and you get to Washington and it's like some of them have never even heard of climate change.
Well, business can only do so much. If you're an optimist, you say, look, we're on a runway to do something to bring us to a low-carbon future. But, you know, if you're a pessimist, you say, listen, right now the scientists tell us we need to keep kind of the warming to 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. And you know what? Right now we're on a path to double that. And that's the reality everybody here is confronting.
Very quickly, Scott, what's the next global conversation on this, the next UN climate change panel? When is that happening?
There's a meeting later this year in Peru, but the big one is in Paris in December of 2015. That's when countries are supposed to pledge particular emissions targets and sign that they'll all commit to meeting those, December 2015.
Marketplace's Scott Tong in New York for the Climate Change Summit. Scott, thanks so much for your time.
Okay, you're welcome.
There was another smaller climate change protest in Lower Manhattan today. It's called Flood Wall Street. A couple of hundred protesters on a sit-down in the financial district. I'm not sure if it was that or just a general meh kind of day, but something put a damper on trading today. We will have the details when we do the numbers. ¶¶ Remember when you used to see people carrying two mobile phones around, one for personal use and one for work, which is to say one for personal use and the other a BlackBerry? Yeah, those days are largely gone now, and BlackBerry's corporate obituary has been written many a time in the past couple of years. But the company is still around, believe it or not, and in point of fact is rumored to be announcing two, count them, two new phones this week. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson has more now on where BlackBerry stands today.
For a couple of years now, vultures have been circling over BlackBerry, especially after a few of its smartphones flopped. But with a pair of new phones, the Classic and the Passport, the company isn't trying to reclaim its old status. Charles Galwin is the founder of Abelian Research.
It would be a mistake to think about BlackBerry as a competitor to Apple and the iPhone or other Android-based device manufacturers. They're not focused on consumers. They're focused on businesses.
Brian Prohm, an analyst who covers BlackBerry for Cowen and Company, says these phones are a play for government, finance, and legal users, for IT managers who will be tempted by their security and BlackBerry's device management software.
The hardcore email user who's in a regulated industry where the keyboard is really a value add, is a differentiator.
The phone is a way to get people to use BlackBerry's software, the company's real focus these days. So is this makeover enough to shoo away the vultures?
The way I see it is, it's a reinvention in progress.
That's Frank Gillette, an analyst at Forrester Research.
And there's still lots of challenges before we know whether they'll survive. So I haven't written them off, but they really aren't competitive anymore in the consumer handset market.
The company's financials aren't the bloody mess they used to be. But you know who else is chasing corporate clients? Apple. It announced a new partnership with IBM recently, with its eyes on a similar business prize. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Over the weekend, as many as 130,000 refugees fled the Syrian civil war, crossing the border north into Turkey, ahead of ISIS fighters who'd been attacking their villages. After three and a half years of that civil war, Turkey is already home to well over a million Syrian refugees who've been moving away from border zones and into some of Turkey's biggest cities. Rengen Arslan from the BBC's Turkish service is near the Turkey-Syria border. Hello, Rengen.
Hello, hi.
Tell me, would you, first of all, what these refugees look like when they cross the border? I imagine they are carrying only the clothes they have on their back, yeah?
Yeah, and some of them carrying their children, too. And many of the refugees are women, as far as I see. And they are carrying also very crucial things. And even today, when I went to a village near the border, I saw a man carrying his birds in a cage. It's very hard to imagine what he would feel if he left the birds at home in an ISIS attack.
Yeah. Where do they go? Are there camps? Are they setting up on the streets? What are they doing?
As far as we talk with the government officials, they say they would pitch tents for them. For example, today I went to another town near the border, and people were using mosque as a refugee camp. All these are makeshift camps. So I think it's Turkish government is not prepared to have these amount of people from the other side.
There have been over the past 3.5 years about a million and a half Syrian refugees into Turkey. So what are those people doing now? Have they been absorbed, or are they still stuck on the border someplace?
I see a lot of Syrian refugees on the streets. Generally, they are begging, and some of them, the lucky ones, can find a job. There are some people who have relatives here, and when they first came here, they are trying to find their relatives. And the ones in Turkey are, of course, just welcomed them to their homes. This is one part. And the other part is the ones who have no relatives in here and who have not got any access to government help. Government organizations help.
When you are at home in Istanbul and when you're in the cities like Ankara and other big places in Turkey and you have Syrian refugees sleeping on the streets and competing for jobs, what do the Turks say then? What do the locals say then?
basically the people are here really competing for jobs, and they think that Syrian people are working for less. So they are getting angry at some point, and there are rumors about everything. Imagine everything.
I'm sure.
These hostility against Syrians are not just taking long time, but it's on a daily basis. But it gives you an idea about what do they feel about these Syrian people at all. Mm-hmm. It's been 3 years now. They have these people in their cities, and it's been getting more and more dangerous, maybe.
Rengen Arslan, the BBC's Turkish service reporter. We got her in Urfa on the Turkish-Syrian border about the refugees coming across in the past couple of days. Rengen, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Coming up.
You need to understand that you're living here for 1 year. These folks are living here essentially for a lifetime.
Getting college kids to understand property values. But first, let's do the numbers. On a Monday, here it is. The Dow Industrial is off 0.6%, 107 points, closed at 17,172, did the blue chips. The NASDAQ gave back 1.1%, 52 points, ended the day at 45.27. The S&P 500 erased 0.8%, that is 16 points. The number is 1994. Concerns about slowing growth in China pushed financials lower. Shares at Morgan Stanley off 1.6%. Citigroup withdrew 0.8%. Goldman Sachs reversed itself about 0.5% or so. Lousy numbers for August home sales. Said housing stock toward the basement. KB Home and Lennar each threw off nearly 3%. Toll Brothers unloaded just over 3%. Get this, even Alibaba was feeling the bad vibes today. After its blowout IPO on Friday, the Chinese giant took a 4% hit. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.56%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. It's the anniversary of the premiere of The Jetsons. The animated series began airing in 1962. Television audiences got a glimpse at living in the space age. Back here in 2014, you may be redecorating. Bed Bath & Beyond releases quarterly earnings. And the boss has a birthday. No, not Mr. Spacely. Bruce Springsteen. He'll be 65. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. This next story reminds me I forgot to set my DVR for this evening's televised entertainment. The new fall season for the broadcast networks is upon us, you know. And Fox has been promoting the heck out of this new show called Gotham. It's kind of a prequel to the Batman story, I gather. And Fox is hoping a comic book hero can save more than just the citizens of that fair city. Stan Alcorn has the story.
Last season, Fox averaged about half the viewers of network leader CBS. And this year, Fox can't count on big draw football games. So the network has to hope that Gotham will help it out of a ratings hole as dark as the comic book city.
However dark and scary the world might be right now, there will be light. There will be light, Bruce.
It's exciting. It's a little scary.
That's Jacqueline Cutler of the Television Critics Association, talking about Gotham, which they voted the season's most promising new series.
I will be absolutely gobsmacked if this is not Fox's huge hit of the year.
But critics have been gobsmacked before, and Fox needs a hit like American Idol used to be. Brad Adgate of Horizon Media says that in its heyday, Idol helped Fox come from behind to lead with the coveted 18 to 49-year-old demographic.
They did that 8 straight seasons, which is unprecedented in the annals of television. You know, they can't rely on that anymore.
Especially at a time when network television as a whole is losing. Brian Weiser is an analyst at Pivotal Research.
Remember, network TV at this point is less than a third of the national TV advertising market. Cable is 2 times bigger.
He expects the networks to continue to lose ground.
So in that context, a decline in ratings at Fox shouldn't be surprising.
Gotham premieres tonight at 8 p.m. Eastern, but with Hulu and DVR, analysts say we won't know the real ratings for another week. In New York, I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
It It took almost a year and 442 million miles, but NASA's latest Mars probe slipped into orbit around the red planet last night. It's going to be looking for clues as to how Mars lost its water. Meanwhile, back on Earth, Europe to be just a tad more precise, some private companies are planning their own Mars ventures. One of them, the Dutch project Mars One, says it's on track for blastoff within a decade. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Not, on the face of it, an alluring prospect. A trip to a bitterly cold, dusty wasteland with no oxygen and not much water. And a one-way trip at that. But 21-year-old Ryan McDonald can hardly wait for liftoff.
I'm going there because I want to live on Mars, spend my life there because that's how I think I can achieve the most for humanity.
Ryan, a physics student at Oxford University, is one of 700 potential settlers on Mars, selected from more than 200,000 applicants.
10, 9, ignition sequence start.
For Ryan, the main motivation is the Apollo program that put man on the moon.
For me, the most important thing is about inspiring a new generation of scientists and engineers. Just look at the Apollo program and all the economic benefits that came out of that. I want to give a new generation their Apollo moment.
But Apollo astronauts came back. There's no return journey for the Mars One's colonizers. However, would-be settlers like 34-year-old school lab technician Alison Rigby seem unfazed by that.
It's happened throughout human history. People have travelled across the planet with no hope of returning to where they came from. So I would just be the next generation of these pioneers.
Cooped up in a pressurised biodome with only three other people at first, isn't life on Mars going to be rather boring?
Yeah, it would be extremely limited, but my background is a chemist. I have a master's degree in chemistry. The opportunity to examine another planet is enticing.
Welcome to London and to the Games of the 30th Olympiad.
The man behind the Mars One mission claims his inspiration for the project came from the Olympics. Dutch entrepreneur Bas Lansdorp says what caught his eye about the London Games was the revenue from sponsorship and broadcasting rights.
Over $4 billion. And the Olympic Games are only 3 weeks of broadcasting, so that's more than $1 billion per week just because the world is watching.
And he says the world would certainly want to watch a human mission to Mars, so raising the $6 billion he needs will be a shoo-in. But the project has its critics. The Lloyd's insurance market in London. Underwriter David Wade is an expert on space. He insures satellites. He doesn't think Mars One adds up.
I think the last time NASA looked at a mission like this was $100 billion. So I think $6 billion is also a highly ambitious target.
And he says he's spotted another flaw in the Mars One business plan. A subsidiary of the Dutch company that created Big Brother has already snapped up the broadcasting rights to the final crew selection process. Wade can see a clash between the demands of interplanetary travel and reality TV.
You want controversial people, you want difficult people, you want drama. That's not the people that you want on a space mission, particularly a one-way mission where you're going to be locked up in a cramped capsule with four colleagues for months on end. It's just fraught with with difficulties to go down that route.
You're a liar! You're a liar and you're a fake! You're a liar!
Which is
Brother does succeed and brings the first bickering emissaries from Earth to the Red Planet, the TV producers face another drawback. They won't be able to evict anyone from the biodome on Mars. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Most, if not all, colleges are back in session by now, which means most, if not all, campuses have seen a party or 10 thrown by now. Fun as those parties may be for students, though, they're not quite always as much fun for homeowners who live nearby. So from our education desk at WYPR, Marketplace's Amy Scott looked into how one neighborhood in Baltimore is coping. They're doing it by rolling out the welcome mat.
On a busy road in Baltimore, Valerie Serrani knocks on the door of a shabby beige house with three mailboxes and Christmas lights lining the windows.
Hi. Hi. Yeah, we're doing our meet and greets. Can you guys come out?
Yeah.
Thanks.
After a few minutes, a dozen or so young men in shorts and T-shirts gather on the front lawn, looking a bit wary. They're all students at Loyola University, Maryland, living in a row of big houses off campus. Serrani hasn't come alone. She's brought with her representatives from the university, someone from City Hall, and a uniformed police officer.
I just wanted to introduce myself. My name is Val, and I'm the Community Association president. Does everyone know what community you're living in?
They don't.
It's Lake Walker. It's a 700-household community.
Lake Walker is a small, middle-class neighborhood in North Baltimore, with Towson University, Goucher College, and Loyola all just a few miles away. Serrani has counted at least 20 houses rented by college students. Today's meeting is part welcome wagon, part warning.
You're part of our community, and we want you to have fun. I went to NYU. I was living in the big city and, you know, did stupid things, but we want you to be safe.
So maybe don't come home from a day of drinking and set out lawn chairs on your slanted roof to watch traffic, like Serrani recently saw some kids on this block doing. She stopped and took a picture.
And the kids obviously saw what I was doing and came down. They were very polite, but extremely intoxicated.
Every year, the minute school starts back up, so do the off-campus parties and the complaints from neighbors about noise, fights, people urinating in the bushes. Officer Doug Gibson shows the students a folder full of police reports just from the past few weekends. If a house gets written up as a neighborhood nuisance, the landlord and tenants can be hit with hundreds of dollars in fines.
Some of the reports already from this block are in that process right now. So there are going to be, most likely, some $500 citations issued already this year.
Afterward, Loyola senior Brian Percoli admits the chat was a little intimidating.
But obviously everything they said is stuff that we already kind of figured.
He also admits that having people over is one reason he wanted to live off campus.
But obviously all within, like, normal human behavior. This isn't like a frat animal house. This is just six good guys living together and just having a good time our senior year.
And they don't have that much choice about where to live. Decades ago, Loyola made an unusual agreement with several neighborhoods in its backyard that its students wouldn't live there. Studies have shown the presence of a college with its cultural activities and open spaces raises property values. That doesn't mean people want its students living next door. Joan Flynn, senior vice president for administration at Loyola, warned the students their behavior reflects on the college.
You need to understand that you're living here for 1 year. These folks are living here essentially for a lifetime. This is the largest investment they'll ever make, just like the home that your parents bought wherever all of you live. The goal here is to be viewed as a contributing member of this community and not an element that diminishes the quality of life of this community.
Efforts like this are catching on at other colleges. Beth Bagwell is president of the International Town Gown Association. She says when students know their neighbors,
it personalizes it and makes it harder to ignore the fact that, you know, Miss Smith next door has a baby and she has to get up at 7 o'clock in the morning.
At the University of Colorado Boulder, some students living off campus are required to attend an orientation before they can collect their keys. They learn about the local nuisance law and hear about the community from a neighbor. Among the houses that have participated, Bagwell says citations for things like noise and property damage have dropped by half.
So they were able to quantify the fact that this was a very successful program, and they're still doing this.
Lake Walker's Valerie Serrani isn't sure. After a meet and greet with students at Towson University the week before, she was inundated with emails from neighbors complaining about a Saturday night party. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, which comes with the observation that Starbucks may, just may, have gone one step too far this time. Love them both, though I do. I am not sure how big a market there's going to be for a coffee drink that tastes like beer. It's called the Dark Barrel Latte. Starbucks workers on Reddit were talking about it this weekend. It's supposed to remind one of stout, I gather. And there are, of course, coffee-flavored stouts, but I don't think it works the other way. Also, this thing's going to have caramel and chocolate and whipped cream in it as well. So really, it's not even coffee either. Come on, right? All right. Yes, I am a purist. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM on this Monday. Today, the Dow off 0.6%, 107 points. The NASDAQ gave back 1.1%, 52 points. The S&P 500 off 0.8%, 16 points. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Tommy Andres, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.